So, good evening. I'm Natalie Anderson. I direct the program in creative writing here at the college, and I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to a reading by Christopher Castellani, an alumnus of the college who's returning this semester to lead our advanced fiction workshop. If any students with some experience in the genre would like to be considered for that course, I urge you to introduce yourselves to Chris after the reading. This is a wonderful opportunity, and we hope you will avail yourselves of the possibility. I've just finished Christopher Castellani's most recent novel, All This Talk of Love, and I can tell you that it had me from its very first sentence. Frankie Grasso and his mother, it says, watch the same soap, but they root for different women. There's so many enticing intimations here. For a start, the intimacy between mother and son deflected into pop culture. And that deflection turns out to be emblematic of the many ways ferocious love gets managed by the characters in this novel, often through refusal, the disappointment unacknowledged, the letter unopened. It's not that Frankie and his mother, Madalena, don't voice their love for each other. They close each nightly phone call with those words. And it's not that this is a reticent family. The same complaints, the same worries, the same stories are repeated, ingrained. Yet each family member has secrets, confessions that can't be spoken, sorrows that can't be borne, self-knowledge that can't be faced, and deflection is their characteristic way of managing. And then, to return to that first sentence, there's the slight transgressiveness of a young man watching soap operas during the day. It turns out that Frankie is working on his PhD in English, which perhaps accounts for his transgressiveness, or anyhow for his leisure time, or rather for his procrastinations and the rationalizations with which he justifies them. They root for different women. He likes the deranged ones, the pregnancy fakers, the poisoners, the tramps. They are necessary research for his chapter on the legacy of the Gothic in the construction of female identity. His mother favors the patient, dutiful wives, they of the shellacked hair and pantsuits and unshakable faith. I relish the distinctions drawn here between radical youth and conventional maturity, like it all the more because it turns out not to be so true. Madalena has sacrificed her way into conventionality and hides behind it unquenchable sorrows. Frankie sleeps with a woman who wears combat boots, his professor, transgressive in almost every way. Yet his dissatisfaction with derangement is palpable. We discover these complexities through the novel's illuminating shifts in point of view. Each major character, mother, father, son, daughter, reveals sensitivities, obsessions, blindnesses. We understand more than they do, more than they reveal to each other. We understand why Madalena refuses to visit Italy while her husband, Antonio, yearns for it. And surprisingly, they're impelled by almost the same emotional reasoning. Again and again in the novel, Castellani offers us analogous scenes, characters playing out similar scenarios or using similar articulations, making us freshly aware of the distinctions, both subtle and major, that underlie such seeming parallels. He anatomizes, too, the ways that tragedy percolates through different lives, souring or paralyzing or solidifying, even transforming. Two conclusions arise from these glimpsed interiorities. First, a quote, "You never know when everything will disappear. There is no permanence, no security, no absolute in this world." Yet also, another quotation, "The world will never end. The world will keep going, with or without them." And that continuity becomes, in the novel, its own consolation, its own blessing. Christopher Castellani, like Frankie Grasso, is the son of Italian immigrants and a native of Wilmington, Delaware. As I've mentioned, he's a Swarthmore alumnus, and he's earned a master's in English literature from Tufts University and a master of fine arts in creative writing from Boston University. He lives ordinarily in Boston, where he's the artistic director of Grub Street, one of the country's leading nonprofit creative writing centers. He's the author of two previous critically acclaimed novels, and I'll say that these novels together form a trilogy. A Kiss from Maddalena, was published in 2003 and was the winner of the Massachusetts Book Award in 2004, and The Saint of Lost Things, published in 2005, a book sense indie-bound notable book that was long listed for the Impact Dublin Literary Award in 2006. In addition to his work with Grub Street, Chris serves on the faculty of the Warren Wilson MFA program and the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and, as I mentioned before, will be teaching the advanced fiction workshop for us here at Swarthmore this semester. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Castellani.
They told me I have to wear this because they're recording this for something. It's going to be online for the Swarthmore website, right? Okay, and I have to turn it on. That was the most important directive, which I would have forgotten. Can everyone hear me? Great. Nat, thank you so much for that amazing introduction. I have to say, sitting there, I thought, well, just hearing that introduction was reason enough to come back to Swarthmore for the semester. But on top of that, I get to teach what I hope will be a great class with, I'm sure, wonderful students. I'm really honored to be back here and certainly honored to be reading for you tonight. And thank you all for taking time out of what is probably already a very busy semester, even though it's day two. Having gone here, I understand how this works. So, and I'm going to read from the beginning of the book, which Nat has already set up for you beautifully, and then I'm going to read from later in the book. And I'm going to cover most of the four characters, three of the four characters in the book. You're going to hear from three of them. The only character you're not going to hear from is the daughter in the book. There are these four characters. It's told from the father, the mother, who are both immigrants, and their adult children, their surviving children, Frankie and Prima. And since I'm teaching the creative writing workshop, I thought I would mention that the narrative strategy that I employed for this book was that I wanted to have each of the characters have their own sections, their own discrete sections separated by white space, not with their names, but by white space, so that you wouldn't have to introduce them, you would just know who was speaking. And they each would have, so when you're in the son's head, you're in the son's head and you're only in the son's head, and when you're in the daughter's head, you're only in her head. The only character who can break in to another character's section is the mother character, the Italian mother character. And any of you who have an Italian mother might sort of get why I did that. And also, she is the character who is carried through all three of the books and who has a particular relationship to knowledge and memory in this book. So that was the rationale behind that. So I'm going to read from the beginning, and then I'll skip ahead, and I'll tell you when I'm doing that. And you've already heard some of this. This is the beginning, so there's no need to set it up. I did want to say this first. The first line of this book I wrote when I was a student here at Swarthmore 1993. And so 20 years later, here it is in this novel. So if that's not inspiration enough, I don't know what is. I wrote that in the creative writing workshop that I took with a visiting professor in Swarthmore in 1993. And here it is again. Frankie Grasso and his mother watch the same soap, but they root for different women. He likes the deranged ones, the pregnancy fakers, the poisoners, the tramps. They're necessary research for his chapter on the legacy of the Gothic and the construction of female identity. His mother favors the patient, dutiful wives, they of the shellacked hair and pantsuits and unshakable faith, and looks to them as examples of proper behavior in 1990s America. Frankie shouldn't be surprised. His mother's life has been a Jeremiad in two languages and two countries, and her 72 years have taught her to distrust romantic passion. Precious minutes on the phone with Frankie she spends wishing doom on the amoral women of daytime, shocked that some network executive has allowed them to stray so far from decency in the middle of the afternoon. In life, she says tonight, after Frankie praises the pregnancy faker for resourcefulness in finding her long-lost identical twin sister and persuading her to carry the baby she can't admit she lost, "You have the truth or you have nothing." And what he wants to tell her is, by that formulation, not a single member of the Grasso family, not to mention anyone he knows, has a blessed thing. Instead, he says, "I'm exhausted. I've been working all night on this chapter. My phone bill's 10 pages long. Wait until she has that baby, then we'll see." "I call you back right now," she says. "I have the money. Daddy put me on a plan, 10 cents a minute. If you can call your cousin in Avezzano twice a week," I tell him, "I can call Boston for a few dimes." "I need sleep," Frankie says. "Then, all right, call me back." He hangs up and takes a sip of whiskey. The light comes on in the window of his neighbor's house, an identical triple-decker, but better maintained. Recently, in his German immersion course, Frankie invented the adjective zusammengetrankt, or thrown together crowdedly, to describe his neighborhood. He loves his word, which looks and sounds like the claustrophobia it conveys, and connotes the grime and desperation of those thickly settled towns that surround and choke a city. "This is your home now," his mother said, the one time she visited. She stood on his crumbling front stoop with her arms outstretched, facing the vista of chain-link fences and vinyl siding. "It's ugly, but it's yours. You'll never want to leave." "It's only a 6-hour drive," he said. "I'll be back all the time." Instead, they settle for Frankie's nightly phone call at 11:01, no matter where he is in the world, one of their many promises to each other. Frankie's friends call their parents once a month and fly home twice a year, less often if they can swing it. Like him, they toil in obscurity in the service of literary scholarship. They have advanced degrees and drug habits and a love affair with irony. Unlike him, the toil, or is it the obscurity, has soured them on distractions like family and authentic human connection. "You really talk to your mother every single night?" they ask him. "How? Why?" "Because she's alive," he says. "But what do you talk about? I haven't spoken an honest word to my mother since kindergarten." "Who said anything about honesty?" he says. He lets the phone ring 5 or 6 times, imagining his mother on the other end, staring into the receiver. When he finally picks up, she says, "What's wrong with you?" And though he thinks of 3 things off the bat, he treats the question as rhetorical and lets her talk. Maddalena Grasso switches the phone to her left ear and again takes up her husband's pants, which she's been hemming off and on for hours. She's been on the phone since 8 o'clock, first with her daughter, then her friend Arlene from the dance studio, then Sister Mary asking another favor for the church, then a wrong number with a friendly voice, and now, finally, always finally, her Frankie. "Your sister was here this afternoon," she says. "You should have seen. She had my old sweatsuit on, the pink one with the rhinestones on the cuffs your tia Ida gave me 30 years ago. She's like a hurricane, your sister, and never any time to sit and have a conversation. She had a bowl of soup and some pasta left over, standing in front of the sink the whole time like a peasant. I said, 'Sit down, 1 second. It's not good always to rush,' but she has no time. She's going to call you this week, she said. She's going to tell you she and Tom got that plot, the one with the water. They had the meeting with the builder, and they got it. The lot, you mean, says Frankie, not the plot. Lot, plot, whatever. And you know the land next to it? You saw it last time. It doesn't have any water, but it has those tall trees like you like. It's an acre almost for sale. And I was thinking, Daddy too, how beautiful it would be for you to live next door to your sister. And you won't have to throw away your money on rent anymore. Who's got that kind of cash? Frankie says. Though if he doesn't shut her down now, she'll offer at least a down payment, a cut of the money she and his father have been saving in his name since the night of his conception, a night she's told him about in more detail than was necessary. For a moment, Frankie allows himself to imagine the unimaginable. He and his girlfriend, Professor Birch, clearing the brush from their little strip of yard, she in her tank top and hairy armpits and army-issue boots, waving to his sister and brother-in-law from across a koi pond. Professor Birch is not the type for big Sunday dinners cooked and served and cleared by women for shared acreage, for lawn care. She's the type who phones her husband while Frankie's inside her to remind him to mail the insurance bill, who makes Frankie call her professor even when she's naked and sullied and rummaging under his bed for her socks. She's exactly the type of woman his mother was afraid he'd meet in the big city. With or without Professor Birch, Frankie has no plans to move back to the suburbs, a fact he can never admit to the woman at the end of the line. He has been called to a bigger and deeper life, far from the narrow bed in which he was planted. And yet it is a stipulation of his unspoken contract with his parents that he treat this stint as a graduate student as temporary, a regrettable but necessary period of time away from home that will allow him to return in triumph as a doctor of philosophy in English literature, secure a highly paid professorship at the university, marry a sweet Italian girl, and start a family like his sister did and his older brother would have done had he lived. When Frankie is quiet for too long, Maddalena worries. He's jealous of his sister and brother-in-law and all their money. He's falling in love with Boston and will never come home. He's too young and confused to think about plots. Let him be, she thinks, but how impossible that is. So she tells him her stories over and over again, in different words but with the same lesson at the end of them, stories about how it was for her to be brought to America from her village across the ocean like a piece of furniture, in love with one man but married to another, a stranger, and just a teenager she was, without a word of the language, and none of it by choice. Not at all like for Frankie, who left his mother in Wilmington 4 years ago, not for love or money or a better life, but for school, as easy as you'd leave a movie if it wasn't making you laugh. You know Prima saved you a place at the table for the confirmation, she says. She has to tell the catering how many people. Every person who doesn't show up, she still has to pay $45. I told her I wasn't coming. You should come, she says, to respect your sister, not because you want to or don't want to. To be honest, Frankie says, I'm disappointed Patrick's getting confirmed at all. I had high hopes for him when he became a Buddhist and gave away his stereo. Don't even mention that, his mother says. He's normal again now, and I've never seen your sister more happy. She takes a pin from between her lips. You know, you can bring somebody if you want. I pay for the train for both of you. Prima put you down for two just in case. I don't need train money. $45 a person, she repeats, and that's without the open bar. Can you imagine? And if you don't belong to the country club, you can pay $100 a person, and still they don't let you have the party there. She lets that sink in for Frankie, though elegant things have never impressed him. Maddalena held all three of her children's first communions at the Aldilà, the Grasso family restaurant, where there was home cooking and plastic red tablecloths and white crepe paper hanging from the walls. For first, the party for Prima, the first child, her daughter, the angel. Then for Tony, the first son born in the new country. Then, 7 years after him, for Frankie, who saved her. Every night when the phone rings and he's there to say, hey, Ma, what's up? He saves her again. Frankie rubs his eyes. Even if Professor Birch could ditch her husband, he knows exactly what they'd do at this silly fete. Chug free cocktails, gorge on the buffet, and spend the rest of the time on the lobby couch sneering at Prima and Tom's unexamined embrace of Catholicism. Worse, Prima's already called to inform him that the confirmation isn't all the Grassos will be celebrating. She has some big announcement, one of her famous surprises, one she wants Frankie to hear in person because it will affect the entire family. She offered no more details, convinced he'd blab to their mother. "Turns out I have to present a paper that weekend," he says to Maddalena. "Not that anyone ever asks me about my schedule. It's kind of a big deal, actually." "They just tell you now?" "The university is not very organized. Harvard. What do you expect?"
"Harvard?"
"Yes, Harvard. Does that make it all right? I can miss the formal induction of my innocent nephew into the racist, sexist, xenophobic institution known as the Roman Catholic Church if I'm speaking at Harvard."
"Do they pay you?"
"Something like this you don't do for the money," he says. "You do it for the prestige." The truth, of course, is that there is no paper and no invitation from Harvard, which won't even let Frankie into its fortress of a library, let alone the, quote, millennium reproaches, colon, anxiety and authorship in the fin de siècle conference. There is certainly no prestige. Despite employing some well-connected and widely published professors, Dr. Birch among them, Frankie's graduate school is solidly second tier, and Frankie himself is passionately meeting, but not far exceeding, its modest expectations. Upon earning their PhDs, he and his classmates can expect not tenure-track positions at coastal universities or the Seven Sisters, but, if they're very lucky, comp and ret jobs at mega-state schools in Des Moines or Tallahassee or some other regional airport city. As far as Frankie knows, he's the only one sleeping with a professor, an advantage he counts as distinct in the job market. Your sister will be devastating, his mother says, but school is more important. "I'm sorry," Frankie says, "I really am. The semester strung me out. I'm not myself. Tell everybody I feel terrible." "Do what you have to do," Maddalena says. "That's why you're up there. Work hard. Stay straight. Drink some whiskey. It helps you sleep." "Excellent idea," he says. "Good night," she says. "I love you."
"Love you too, Ma. Good night."
"Good night, Frankie," she says. "I love you. I love you." It's important to her to say the words until she's sure he's hung up. "Bye, Ma," Frankie says. "I love you. Bye." It's important to him to say the words until he's sure she's hung up. And once again, she has spared him, this time as so many before. How easy life can be, Frankie thinks, when your mother knows so little of the world and you are not her favorite son. So I'm going to skip ahead a bit, quite a bit, and read from the father's perspective. And in the meantime, what's happened is that that big announcement that Frankie mentions is that his sister is decided she wants to take the entire family back to their ancestral village in Italy, and she's paying for the whole thing. And that's the surprise, that she's bought the tickets and she's wants them all to go. And the parents who've never been back, Maddalena refuses to go back for reasons she sort of is explaining and won't explain at the same time. And Antonio, the father, is desperate to go back because he longs for his village. Other things you need to know is that the Aldilà, as I mentioned, is the restaurant that Antonio and his brother have built, and it's about 40 years old now, so it's an established restaurant, and Antonio is wondering what's going to happen to it after he passes. And you also know that they've had a son, Tony, who's passed away, sorry, and all we know until now is that he went missing at 15 and was found in the river, and that he presumably jumped off the Delaware Memorial Bridge, and no one knew why, and that Maddalena and Antonio had Frankie as a kind of replacement child. You also need to know that throughout these early chapters, Antonio is noticing Maddalena's kind of strange behavior, but he keeps it to himself. The behavior has gotten dramatically worse over the holiday season. Things like she's putting food away in the wrong cabinets and saying she washed dishes that were still dirty. So she's sort of showing signs of something wrong with her mind. Antonio's in his late 70s. This guy Giulio is their family friend. And that's, I think, all you need to know for this next part. So this is from later in the book. And the chapter title was originally, and I liked it better, so I'm going to say it. The editor made me change it, but the chapter title originally was Someone is Always Missing. The house is finally, this is Christmas Eve, the house is finally quiet. Antonio in his chair in this room of unwrapped presents and empty tossed aside envelopes watch his midnight mass at the Vatican on TV. The sound's on mute because the picture is all that matters. Get the camera off the Pope, he thinks. Show the people, show the piazza, and if you can, swing the lens over the mountains 40 miles to Santa Cecilia, buried in snow. Show me my old house, the chestnut trees, the frozen spring. But the picture doesn't change. The Pope mumbles on. From the window, he can see St. Mary's, the church that holds his family, most of his family. Not Tony, not Mario. Someone is always missing. The parking lot is packed with the cars of hypocrites. He's not one of them. When he needs God, he turns over in his bed and puts his arm around his wife and says, "Tesoro, tesoro." He doesn't need a new red sweater or a polo wallet or a gift certificate for a haircut at some overpriced salon. He feels every dollar his wife and kids waste on him, on stupidaggini, on anything, as an insult. You want to show me you love me? Save your money. Show some respect. Finish your school. Take me to Santa Cecilia, where I belong. I can count on one hand the years we have left together. He is there now in his village, a boy again in his heavy coat, the grown-ups around him with candles in their cupped hands, the church cold as a crypt. There is the ceramic baby Jesus at the altar to kiss and adore. Or maybe it's plastic. Did they have plastic back then? When did plastic start? The years are a jumble. Antonio was a boy of 7 and Maddalena was a baby. The day her parents announced her, they propped her on the counter of the grocery and customers came to welcome her to the world. Antonio looked up at her wiggling toes, at her Chiacchierone sisters pinching her cheeks. The Piccinellis lived down the street from his family. They owned that big store and the Grassos owned a tiny pezzetto of land, a 3-room house and a few chickens. The baby Maddalena was pure white. No dirt under her fingernails, no marks on her skin. She glowed in the sunlight of the grocery window. He may have invented all of this, the light, the baby on the counter, but it's as real as the fire beside him on this Christmas Eve, 72 years later. He reaches up to tickle Maddalena's toes. His father is not there to slap his hand away. His father has been gone 40 years. How strange to be at the end of life so soon. 72 years from one midnight to another, from the boy at the counter looking up at the old man in the chair, from the boy at the counter looking up to the old man in the chair looking back. So what if he feels sorry for himself? He's not allowed. He's never been a brave person. He's not one of those immigrants to write a book about, the ones who came to America with empty pockets. He had a mother and father to lead him by the hand on and off the ship, find him his first job, give him a house with a finished basement and a yard with a grape arbor. He had friends, cars, girls, a brother to put up half the money for a restaurant, a faithful wife. An ordinary life split into two worlds. Soon when he's gone, a few of those people over at St. Mary's will cry, but only for a little while. Their lives are full enough without him. The customers will still come to the Aldila for their calamari and stuffed shells. They'll sit waiting for their tables under the framed black and white photo of Antonio and Mario with their arms around each other, and if they notice the photo at all, they'll say, maybe, aw. Strange to be a sad old man in an easy chair, the years settling on him like dust, and yet not strange at all. He and his bocce friends at the lodge talk of nothing but the years. Moments ago, they say I was a man of 25 leaning over the railing of a ship, watching Italy sink into the ocean. Their kids, like Antonio's, appeared one day like magic, then disappeared. Why did nobody warn them of the grief of fatherhood? Not that your kids grow up and leave you in every possible way, but that they're strangers from the start. They don't stand still long enough. They let you get only so close, and you work too many hours, and they tell their friends their secrets, and they love you, but with their souls only, the way they love their country, or God. Their hearts belong to other people. He is the only person alive who knew the secret of Tony's heart. He keeps it closer than any he's ever known. It's like a heavy stone in his pocket, one he takes out
on nights like this, when nostalgia's got him by the balls, when he's got too much time to turn the stone over and over and rub it with his thumb, as if it's beautiful and precious, when, in truth, it was the one bit of ugliness in his son, and it was the ugliness that killed him. When he can shut the rest out, this is how Antonio chooses to remember his oldest son, a boy who loved his father and the place his father built. From the age Tony could walk and talk, the only thing he liked more than walking and talking at his father's side was walking and talking at his father's side at the Aldilà. No one has loved the restaurant so strong since then. After school, Tony would come straight to the Aldilà and sit for hours in a booth doing his homework. When that was done, he'd fold napkins, arrange the forks and knives on the tablecloths, cut the slices of cheesecake and store them in the refrigerator. He drew new logos and signs for the restaurant on the backs of the placemats and showed them to his father, joking that when he grew up and took over, he'd make the place more modern. He had a talent for design, for making the perfect crease in the napkins, for spacing the knives and forks exactly the right distance apart. By the time he was 14, in 1970, he was doing the work of a busboy, making better tips than some of the waiters, because who couldn't fall in love with him? He was already tall, already handsome, the shadow of his first beard growing, his legs strong, his face lit up for the old ladies. There was a waiter that summer, Dante, the son of Marconi, the electrician. Antonio hired him as a favor to his father, even though he had no experience. Dante was nothing special. Worse, he had a tattoo on his left leg and big horse teeth and a ponytail. He was on his way to becoming a derelict, another of those children who wasted their parents' sacrifices. But he had charm. The customers asked for him by name, and Tony followed him around like a puppy dog. It was after Dante came in June of 70 that Tony changed. Dante brought him albums and taught him to do mean but perfect imitations of the managers, Gilberto and Lucio. Lucio had a high, girly voice, Gilberto a stutter, and both imitations made everybody laugh. Dante pushed Tony to play pranks on the dishwashers and cooks and his sister to hide their aprons or their salt until they got so mad they started fighting with each other. He made it Tony's job to cover his tables while he snuck off for cigarettes with his long-haired friends who hung around outside the restaurant near the bus stop, waiting for the end of his shift. Dante's act bothered Antonio from the beginning, but he put up with it because of his friendship with Marconi and the free electric work, and because Tony liked having him at the Aldilà. When the two had different schedules, Tony sulked and yawned and sat in the corner writing in a book of guest checks he carried around in his apron so he would feel like a real waiter. One day, Antonio overheard Lucio asking one of the other boys, "What's the prince always scribbling?" He was the worst gossip of all, Lucio, still is. "Who knows," said the busboy. "He's a smart kid. He's probably doing his homework." "In the summer? In the checkbook?" said Lucio. "It's not normal, all that writing. It's too many words." Antonio ignored this at first. He couldn't blame Lucio for not liking Tony or Dante because of all the teasing they did about his high voice. Then he watched his son more closely. Tony took that book of checks everywhere. Whenever he got a free second, he'd write in it with concentration. At the end of every day, he'd tear out a handful of pages, stuff them in his pocket, and throw the rest of the book in the trash. One day, the widow, Ida, called to say she needed help in her kitchen. Could Antonio send over somebody tall and strong? He sent Tony, who left his apron behind on a hook in the kitchen and in its front pocket the book of checks. Ida did not live far. Antonio had only a few minutes. From the window of the Aldilà, he watched Tony cross Union Street, jog over to 8th, and turn the corner toward Itzia's house. He had long legs and thick dark curls and a smart head on his shoulders. He was so young and innocent and decent, with a long life ahead, full of every possible good thing. This is the other way Antonio chooses to remember him, his son who turned the corner that day and came back someone else. Antonio flipped through the lime green pages. First the specials, the lists of orders, a running tally of tips. The middle was blank. Then he got to the back pages. Tony's handwriting, small and scratched, filled the lines. He'd crammed words into every inch like he was a prisoner, and that these the last scraps of paper he'd get. They were letters, some to himself, some to Dante Marconi. Dante's name was on every page. But as letters, they made no sense. No boy in his right mind sent letters like this. "Do something, Tony Grasso," they said, "before it's too late. Find a priest. Go to the bridge. Your mother will be better off. It's too late already. Too late." What was he talking about? Too late for what? What was Dante doing to him? "You have flour all over your legs today. You are the beginning and the end. Take me for a ride with Bruce and Mikey and the guy with the broken arm. Take me anywhere. Why aren't you talking to me today?" Then some kind of poem about a field in the spring. Then a dream about the ocean. "In my dream, a wave knocked you down, and when you came up for air, you had a hole in your back like a whale." At the top of the dream page, that name again, Dante. Antonio didn't understand. The black and blue ink marks blurred into a loud mess of nonsense. Scarabocchi, his teachers back in Santa Cecilia used to call sloppy handwriting. Scarabocchi, she taught him, was a sign of disrespect. When Tony and Prima did their homework, Antonio sometimes stood guard over them as they wrote, watching like a hawk for Scarabocchi. He couldn't necessarily help them get the right answers, but he could insist that their handwriting showed respect. Straight rows of neat letters, clear numbers, not this disgraceful mess of Tony's. "You don't write so sloppy and small," Antonio knew, "unless you are ashamed." He tore out the last three pages and hung the apron back on the hook. He went to the dessert fridge where Dante was scooping out portions of tiramisu onto a plate. "Go home," Antonio said, grabbing the plate. "You don't work here anymore. Fuck Marconi and his free repairs. Who cared that Dante chased after him, asking why, saying, 'Please, please, Signor Grasso, what did I do?'" Antonio didn't say another word. All that sissy begging made him want to punch him in the face. Antonio left out the back door and walked down Union. If he could stop time and think hard, Tony's words would make sense. He shoved the pages deeper into his pocket. He wandered the streets, past the old men in their folding chairs, made a left and then another left, forgot where he'd turned. At the next intersection, he got so confused, here in the Little Italy neighborhood he knew better than his backyard, that he couldn't remember how to get back. He stood for a long time, paralyzed, dizzy. Cars rushed past. The traffic lights blinked. Then someone called his name. Giulio Fabbri stood on the other side of the street, 7th Street, so he'd gone in a big circle, and waved. "Antonio Grasso," he yelled again. He was standing in front of his house. "You here for a visit?" He walked toward him, arms out. "Come on in," he said. "Come in," he said. Giulio led him into his little empty row house. He talked on and on, politics, the weather, neighborhood gossip. Antonio was still paralyzed. Every month, Giulio said, more Italians moved out of the city. He was sad to see them go, to see a neighborhood of strangers. Tears were forming in Antonio's eyes, and Giulio stopped. "What is it, Wayo?" He took out the pages, now crumpled and smudged, from his pocket. "I'm sorry," he said. "I don't know what to do." He laid them on the table between the glasses of wine Giulio had poured. "Tell me what they mean." They called Giulio Fabbri the professor of Little Italy. He had some college. He understood poems and dreams. Antonio hadn't ended up on 7th Street by accident. The professor would find a normal reason for Tony's letters, tell Antonio not to worry, they were harmless. The boy was so young, we all get crazy ideas when we're young. Giulio put on his glasses. He read all three pages twice. Then he took a sip of wine, folded the pages in half, and slid them back over to Antonio. He looked him in the eyes. "I'm sorry, compa," he said. "This is bad, very bad, maybe, but it doesn't have to be. Tell me." His son had an unhealthy crush, Giulio explained, an infatuation. What made it bad news, of course, was that the infatuation, the romantic idea he should have for a girl, was for the Marconi boy. This idea got him twisted in the wrong direction. "You see men like this on the news," he said. "You read about them in literature, the Greeks, even some Romans. But you never think they can be someone you know, someone of your own blood." The good news, according to Giulio, was that first, that Tony was young, and there was still time for him to grow out of it, and second, that the Marconi boy didn't share his feelings. Nothing had happened between them. Giulio pointed to the bottom of the first page. "You don't know I'm alive. You don't see me. You will never drive me to New York. Dante, 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 Dante." "That tells me there's nothing happening from the other side," said Giulio. "He's only 14, Antonio said. "What kind of feelings can he have yet?" Giulio smiled. "What kind of feelings did you have when you were 14? And he's almost 15 in 2 months. Antonio stood and walked to the other end of the kitchen. "This Dante, He's got a ponytail. He looks like a girl. That's a good sign, Julia said. Then, you know some of the greatest artists in history, but he didn't finish the thought. It can't be, Antonio said. You can't tell anything based on that mess. He waved his arm toward the check still folded on the table. You can be wrong. It could be just a joke he's playing. He took the pages and tore them into a million pieces. That part you read, it doesn't even make sense. You'll never drive me to New York. That could mean anything. Like what? Like he wants to go to New York, Antonio said. See the Statue of Liberty. It can't be what you're saying. You can't tell me there's no chance you're wrong just because you read books. I never said there was no chance. I hope I am wrong, said Giulio Fabbri. That boy is like my son, too. You think we want this for him? He folded his hands. It's more common than you think, especially these days. It's a scary time, all those crazies in California. Just keep an eye on him. It can go away, I think. It's not impossible. It can be what they call a phase. I know what a phase means, Antonio said. I don't have as much school as you, but I know the basic words, and I have common sense, and common sense tells me this can't be. There are always signs, they tell you. The newspaper and TV shows, all they talk about is signs. You're supposed to look for them and then know what they mean when you find them, but Antonio's never trusted himself to read signs. He's a man, a father, easily blinded by love, by the faith that if you want something badly enough for you or for your children and work hard to get it, it will come to you. After that day in Giulio's kitchen, he was as blinded as ever by love for Tony, more blind, if you can be such a thing, and wanted more fiercely than he'd wanted anything in his life for Giulio to be wrong, for his son to turn out normal, healthy, untouched. So we watched him. He stole more checks, read more pages of the same scarabocchi about Dante, always and only Dante, long after Antonio chased him from the Aldilà. He went through every scrap of paper in his room, looked in the back of his dresser drawers, under his bed, in the corners of his closets. He smelled his clothes, checked behind the mirrors. He listened in on his phone calls. He followed him home from school, kept two blocks behind him in his car. He waited in the parking lot while Tony sat with his friends in a booth at the charcoal pit, looking happy enough. Right up to the day. When he went missing, they searched his room, pulled out his desk drawer, and turned it upside down. Index cards, notebooks, and a stack of rubber-banded guest checks fell to the floor. Quickly, Antonio slipped the guest checks into his pocket. He kept them with him, reading them over and over for a clue to where his son might have run off. 2 days later, they dragged his body from the river. Tony left his family with ugly words. Antonio burned them in a garbage can in the backyard. At the funeral, he avoided Giulio Fabbri's eyes and never spoke to the man again. When Giulio visited the house at holidays, Antonio walked past him without a nod, talked over him when he tried to tell a story. After a while, Giulio understood the sign, stopped coming to the Grassos altogether, and not long after that, he was dead too, and there wasn't a person left who knew Tony's heart the way his father did. Lately, that miserable time comes back to Antonio like a movie in his head he can't turn off. The words on the guest checks won't stay down. They shout at him from the dirt behind the garbage cans, the flower on Dante's legs, the body falling from the bridge. Tony asking him with his crumpled up, destroyed face when he got back from helping his Zia Ida why he'd sent his best friend away. And there are times like now when Antonio feels, can he even admit it, relieved. Almost grateful that Tony died when he did, as he's learned more of the ways of the world, seen it change and rot before his eyes, he's come to convince himself his son would never have survived it. 40-year-old men dying from pneumonia, teachers at the dance studio prancing around in their tight pants, unashamed, protests in San Francisco and D.C., parades in New York, celebrating. Would that have been Tony's life, Agrasso's life? He'd have been 43 this year. What does 43 look like for that kind of man? Would he be wasting away to a talking skeleton like Rock Hudson, who'd once been handsome and rich and on top of the world? As impossible as it's been for Antonio to imagine Tony's adult life, it's worse to feel this relief, this sickening gratitude, so he pushes it away. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. From the window, he sees the cars leaving in the church parking lot. He goes downstairs, turns on the spotlight, and walks to the end of the driveway without his coat. Before long, his family rounds the corner, Then they say their goodbyes and see you tomorrows, and Prima and Tom and the boys get in their cars. Too many cars for one family, a waste of gas and mileage and extravagance. Before Frankie can disappear into his room, Antonio asks him, "So how was church?" "How do you think?" Frankie says, smiling. "Smoke, mirrors, hypocrites." They share this, at least. Neither of them believes in God or trusts the Catholic Church to do anything for you except take your money. "Thank you for going," Antonio says. "It means a lot to your mother." Frankie shrugs. "It's good people watching." They can talk like this only when Maddalena's not in the room. Just as Antonio is about to ask Frankie more questions, isn't he glad he got it out of the way tonight instead of having to get up early tomorrow morning? Are any of his friends in Boston religious? What does he think keeps people coming back year after year for the same nonsense? Maddalena comes toward them. Frankie winks, and they kiss each other goodnight. The dining room table is cleared, the dishes are clean, and the hallway swept. Only the den remains a mess. The presents, the wrapping paper crumpled into balls, the pine needles. Antonio and Maddalena will take care of this tomorrow, together, before they drive with Frankie out to Greenville. Now it's time to rest. Maddalena closes all the lights. She lies on the couch in front of the tree, using her old flowered house dress for a blanket. Antonio goes back to his chair, then changes his mind and sits beside her, her feet and ankles in his lap. They don't talk. They're both so tired. "Another year," she says. The TV stays on mute. The tree glows. They fall asleep this way eventually, and when they wake, it's morning, and the tree lights are still on, and Tony's still gone, and they're still older than they've ever been, and it's like any other day. Except when Antonio says, "I'll make the coffee," Maddalena asks, "But who are you?" Thank you.